Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we are back. Thank you for joining us for yet another episode of the Startup Hustle Podcast. I'm your host, Lauren Conaway, founder and CEO of Innovate Her KC. And I do have to tell you, today's episode of Startup Hustle is sponsored by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Definitely check them out if you are looking to build a software product. They can definitely do some really great work for you. So today, super excited about this conversation. I was actually telling our guest before we hit the record button, because we're going to be talking to Atticus LeBlanc. He is founder and CEO of PadSplit. And I'm just so excited to talk to Atticus because we're going to be discussing, affordable housing. We're going to be discussing, you know, technology and how we can empower individuals to connect, to solve shared housing model issues and helping people get connected to housing. And I'm really excited about that because that speaks to something that is very near and dear to our hearts at Startup Hustle, which is access, removing barriers to entry, helping people live well, all of these things that we love. Atticus, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yay! I always love when our guests are excited to be on the show. It makes me really happy. I'm just going to ask you, I'm going to give you the softball question, my friend. Here it comes. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about your journey.
My name is Atticus. I was named after Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird, for anyone wondering. Yeah. Happily married, father of four boys. Here in the Atlanta, Georgia area. And I am the founder and CEO of PadSplit. Been a longtime entrepreneur, going on 16 years now.
Wow. That's impressive. Entrepreneurship is not for everybody. So people who are OGs who've been around for a while always impress me. I'm like, you have a high tolerance for stress. Like when you say that to me, that's what I know.
it's true. I think I was actually just talking to another entrepreneur before this call and talking about the value of just surviving and survive long enough to see the opportunities. And the analogy I like to give is make sure that you can feed yourself with minnows while you're out whale hunting. Because otherwise,
I love that. Did you come up with that?
I think so.
I'm writing that down. I told you I have a pad and a pen here. I'm writing that down. Sure. I love that.
I've at least been saying it long enough where I'm ready to take credit.
What? I will credit you moving forward. I'm just going to go ahead and assume that belongs to you. Well, so Atticus, tell us about PadSplit. I know that you are a Startup Hustle Top Atlanta company, and we are very excited about that. Congratulations on the acknowledgement and recognition. Thank you. Tell us about PadSplit. What do you do?
Sure. Yeah. So essentially what we do is furnish room rentals in a nutshell. To be a little more provocative, we share housing so that we make it more affordable and more profitable simultaneously. And you move strangers in together is the TLDR. And really the idea is I've been in the 16 years I've been an entrepreneur, it's mostly been in the housing space and primarily in the affordable housing sector. And the two major issues to solving affordable housing are, one, you need to increase supply, and sure. two, you need to improve access and remove a lot of those barriers to entry. And shared housing was the most direct way and the fastest and most cost-effective way that I thought we could solve both of those issues. So that's, in a nutshell, what we do. It's it is a marketplace. So we find folks who have housing. Traditionally, that has been investors who are focused on the bottom line and demonstrated to them how through a shared housing model, we can actually create spaces that are more affordable, but because they are shared, they also improve the bottom line for those investors. And if it's more profitable for those investors, then the idea is that they go out and create more. And the more opportunities that we can create for folks who don't have access to other traditional housing opportunities.
Yeah. Well, so you've really created a win. Actually, you've created a win-win, but you've actually created a win-win-win because communities where people are housed are healthier. And I want to talk to you a little bit about that. You know, you kind of touched on it, but talk to us about, there is an affordable housing crisis in our country. And I want to hear, can you give us some context around that?
Sure. Yeah. I think at the end of the day, the most important thing that I would want listeners to focus on is this comes back to the fundamental law of supply and demand. And we have been undersupplying our housing stock for a very long period of time. This well predates the pandemic. And I mean, we started to see early indications when I started investing in real estate in 2008. But even before then, it was an issue, and specifically an issue for folks that are earning, call it less than $40,000 a year, where you have both a lack of supply and real inhibitors to access. So it's been with us for a long, long time. And I mean, you can even go back to the 1950s and 60s where the housing production paradigm was focused on two parents, two kids living in the suburbs. And the reality is our demography of the country has changed dramatically and started shifting then. So when this was the product that was predominantly being built, you weren't creating the supply that was necessary for the singles, the couples, even the single parents, that was a much better reflection of the people who actually needed housing.
Right. Yeah, I was scrolling mindlessly through Facebook this morning and saw it was a meme, of course, but it said something along the lines, it showed a picture of a house and it said, this house, when it was originally built, was worth, you know, $69,000. And then today it is worth $250,000. The annual teacher's salary when this house was built was $65,000. It has increased to $69,000. So there's an economic disparity in housing prices as correlated to cost of living, for sure. And so the fact that you are addressing that is really, really important. And I just want to say thank you for doing that.
Of course.
You've created a mechanism that empowers people. Like when we talk about, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of need, you think of those base needs, shelter, food, you know, health, things like that. You know, housing is right there. It's so important. And having people, helping people to feel secure, helping people to, you know, have a place to put their stuff and lay their head and take a shower. And it's just crucial to, it's so many levels.
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes even deeper than that. I mean, one of the things that we say a lot is just a core belief that the people who serve our communities deserve at least an opportunity to live in them. And I think the general public is largely unaware that you can have full-time employment and not have any housing access in almost every city in America. It's just fundamentally wrong. But that there are a lot of systemic reasons that have led to that reality. And we're doing what we can to address them. I mean, two quick highlights, as I mentioned, just to frame the problem for folks, you look at single family housing specifically, and the average new home size, over the last 60 years has tripled. So we're building houses now that are roughly three times the size that they were 50, 60 years ago. But at the same time, you look at family sizes and they've declined more than 20% to the point where now, if you look at our housing stock today, about 12.5% of total housing stock are studios and one bedroom apartments. But 73% plus of the population would be in the right like family size grouping to be in demand for that housing. So you have a population that's 73% of all folks here in the U.S. Competing effectively for what is 12.5% of housing stock, or at least is right sized for 12.5% of housing stock. And so there's a real mismatch there. And really what we try to do is just to create that supply by rethinking how we are using the housing that already exists, that's just in these much larger spaces that can be reconfigured.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. And I recently watched a webinar, and it was actually put on by an architectural firm here in the Kansas City area. And they were talking about the fact that not only are we dealing with, you know, housing discrepancies and market discrepancies, but we're also dealing with an infrastructure problem. The fact that our city centers tend to be the places like cities that have urban cores, where we talk about folks who have, there are a lot of distressed properties and there are some socioeconomically depressed areas. But these are the areas that actually tend to fund our suburbs. And so here in our country, we're experiencing a sprawl problem because we have population density in our cities. And so the tax base and the tax dollars are coming out of these areas at a higher rate, and they are being used to fund, you know, things like roads and things like, you know, I don't know, lights and all of those things that taxes pay for. And so we're looking at a lot of different disparities, systemic issues that are inhibiting people's ability to be housed affordably, comfortably. And it's crazy. And I love the fact that you're coming up with a solution, you know, and the solution that you have, you're not necessarily reinventing the wheel, but you are disrupting people's access to it. You know, you think about, you know, families in countries around the world and you see multi-generations living in the same house. Well, in America, we don't really have that here. You know, we have one family per home. We have single people per home. And so using this shared housing model, it's actually a little disruptive. How did you come to that? Can you talk to us about your process?
I mean, I want to be very careful to disclaim that in no way is shared housing my idea. I mean, we've been doing it since we lived together in caves, 200,000 years ago when humans were first, you know, arrived on the scene. But even in the U.S., I mean, you look back 100 years, and it was very common. One of the stories I find interesting is I talked to my mother about this recently, and her godfather was a laborer who rented a room from her grandmother. Her grandmothers on both sides of her family rented rooms in their homes, and it was just second nature. It was just a thing that people did. And if you go back and you look at historic architecture, throughout the U.S. and even in many suburbs, houses were designed to have rooms available to rent to workers. And today we look at it, or I think certainly a lot of suburban populations look at it as anathema, but the reality is it was totally commonplace and totally accepted pre-World War II and pre the suburbanization and this single family kind of 1950s, 1960s mindset of the car in the garage and the again the family living in the home with the backyard,
the nuclear family with the white picket fence.
Yeah, exactly. But it was that we're living with the vestiges of the 50s and 60s and not of the teens and 20s and 30s and even the 40s.
Sure.
It's really powerful. I think probably a lot of it gets to pop culture and just the advent of television and a lot of what those families saw and the kind of social and cultural fabric of the 60s. It's not at all historic. And what we're doing is really trying to get back to the way that our cities were developed and the way that our societies have lived, not just for the last 100 years, but for thousands and thousands of years.
Right.
And just trying to introduce technology so that we can rebuild the trust with our community that has largely been eroded just in recent memory.
Yeah. Well, so talk to us a little bit about the platform. I'm really curious. You're connecting all of these different entities. You're connecting, you know, renters, you're connecting property owners, you know, you're involving the community. Talk to us a little bit about specifically about how the platform works.
Yeah. So the main thing is I'll take it first from the owner side, because that's reasonably easy. A property investor or real estate owner is generally motivated by the bottom line. And what they need from us is the ability to fill those spaces with qualified leads who are going to pay and not destroy the home. And so that's the first thing, and really the three Sure. things that they're primarily concerned about. It's much more complex on the resident side, who we refer to internally as members, because we want them to think of this as more than just housing, more than just a room. And we offer some other services as well, including access to telemedicine and credit reporting, and may include Wow. features as well. But for those folks, and that's really where it gets interesting. A typical housing arrangement would require a pretty significant upfront deposit and then rent payable on the first of the month. And then you've got to furnish the property and you've got to set up utilities for the property. And then you have to pay all these things on different dates. And so from a user experience standpoint, we wanted to, number one, remove a lot of those barriers. If we already acknowledge that a huge portion of the U.S. population doesn't have access to $400 for an emergency expense, well, then that's going to dramatically limit the types of housing opportunities that are relevant for them. And then if you look at how a lot of those property managers or landlords restrict access, they often require 3 times the monthly rent as an income requirement. And so what Right. this means is, if you say a quote unquote affordable apartment is $1,000 a month, well, then what that means is somebody's going to have to make 40 grand a year in order to qualify. Well, how many workers in America make less than $40,000 a year? Holy cow, that's a big number.
Right.
And that's at $1,000 a month. Our average all-inclusive payment, which includes furniture, utilities, Wi-Fi, laundry, and then credit reporting and telemedicine, is around $640 a month.
Wow. And,
the next thing that we did was to say, okay, well, what day of the week, depending on when you're listening to this podcast, what day of the week is the first of next month? And unless you happen to be listening and like tomorrow is the first of the month, you're probably going to struggle to come up with what day of the week that happens to fall on. And yeah. it almost never has any correlation with what your payday happens to be. from your job. Whereas I know today is Friday, for instance. And so if I happen to get paid on Friday and I have one bill that includes all of my utilities and everything, and it happens to be on due on that day, then I'm much more likely to pay it right. and to be able to pay it and budget around it. And then on top of that, we said, okay, well, we know that if we make those payments easy to remember and all inclusive, there's really very little risk of the person not making that payment, certainly dramatically reduced from what it had been in a traditional real estate rental environment. And so that alleviates the need for a large upfront deposit. And so now that deposit is really just baked into one simple move-in fee that covers the cost of someone turning that room, of a landlord having to make ready that room for the next person and cleaning and whatnot to get it ready for the next person. So it's, you're talking about a $29 application fee, $100 move-in fee, and then a payment that can be made either weekly or tied directly to that person's payday. So that's super easy to remember. And all of those things mean that we can provide access to a group of folks that have historically not been able to have access at all. And median income for us today is around $22,000 a year for our members on the platform. And often have credit that wouldn't qualify for them for traditional housing opportunities either.
Wow. That is absolutely, that's incredible. I have so many questions swirling around in my head. It's ridiculous. but so the first one, and this might be an easy one and it might not, but when you engage a new member using PadSplit, what do you have the numbers on the percentage of on-time payments?
So we have an effective collections rate and have for the last 3.5 years north of 95%. And so that's
amazing. Well, and when you see that happen, there are a lot of secondary and tertiary benefits. Like, not only does this individual get to stay in their home, but you also see credit rates rise, and there's definitely some mental health benefits as well. I imagine not having to worry. You're simplifying what it can be a very convoluted, complicated process. Hashtag adulting. But that's amazing. I love that. So I want to ask you this. I want to ask you about 20 questions, but the first one that I want to ask you is, how did you do that when you were building the platform and you were building the process? You've streamlined, and you have, I'm assuming you had to build up goodwill with, property owners and things like that to kind of explain, this is how this is going to work. And it sounds real weird, but it's going to work. We promise. What did that process look like?
The first thing, we actually got started out of an affordable housing ideas competition with Enterprise Community Partners, who's a national nonprofit. Yeah. And they ran a contest, and that was sponsored by JP Morgan Chase Foundation. And I just submitted this white paper because I had been experimenting with shared housing for years and kind of saw the relative benefits. But they gave us a grant for $10,000. And so I took that $10,000 and converted one of my own properties to what I thought should be the prototypical model. And I could prove to those investors pretty early on that this was working that we could have both these transformational life impacts for the people inside the home, as well as a significantly improved bottom line. And that was sufficient to get the first investors, and then when they started doing it on their own and listing on the platform and seeing those early successes, of course they went out and did more homes and told their friends, and it really grew organically from there. But I think it's just representative of the product selling itself in many ways, and you have to experience it to believe it. And as soon as people experienced it, they went on to go do more. And on average, every owner who comes onto the platform, we know, will do two additional homes within the next 12 to 18 months.
That's absolutely amazing. And I do have to apologize to you listeners at home and to you, Atticus, because I've been so interested in what you're saying that I forgot to remind everybody that today's episode of Startup Hustle is sponsored by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. And when we talk about, you know, entities and people and organizations that can help you, Fullscale is definitely right there at the top of the list. Definitely reach out to them. They are really, really good at putting together awesome teams to help you get your product out there in quick and fast and efficient ways. So definitely check them out. We are here with Atticus LeBlanc, founder and CEO of PadSplit. And I'm going to dive right back in because I'm so intrigued by this whole process. Like, I have this big old smile on my face because I'm just like, this sounds so cool. So talk to us. I want to talk about the user experience now. Like, you kind of explained that you are a one-stop access point for housing and for living, and I love that. But how do you find your members? How do you engage them? How do you explain this process to them?
We try to be as direct as we can. And if you go on the site, it's just says fully furnished rooms for rent. And to your point about Maslow's hierarchy, I mean, usually when someone is new to town, or if they're in a job as a paramedic or an in-home health aide or a substitute teacher or a delivery driver of some sort, and they're just looking for an option that is reasonably accessible to their place of employment. So for them, I think they come to us really just with a transactional need in mind, that they are trying to find some place where they can live independently, where their other options may be either living with family or staying with friends on their sofa or some other very substandard option, or in many cases, living in an extended stay motel at least twice the cost. And so they're just looking for an option, and they come to us because they are looking for a room for rent. Hopefully they realize that we are more than just a room. And in a lot of cases, we get responses much later on, not having any idea that we were reporting credit, and they're shocked in a good way that they see their credit scores have increased during their stay with us. And we know that more than 85% of our members increase their credit scores during their stay with us.
Wow.
But it doesn't really make too much of a difference for us why they come to us. It's really just we think people need a lot more choices, and we happen to be one of those choices, and just present ourselves as such. And in many cases, people are able to just take advantage of those opportunities and do some amazing things. We've had a handful of people that have actually gone on to purchase their own homes, which is amazing. We've had lots of folks that have saved enough money to purchase cars or start businesses or make the move that they always wanted to make. And that's really inspiring for me personally. And yeah. One of the reasons that I love doing this.
And you're so humble about all of this. Like, I just want to call that out. Something else that I want to call out, and we've kind of touched on it a little bit, but you know, when you're talking about working with marginalized communities, whether that is socioeconomic or racial or gender based, or you know, one of the things that we talk about in I guess kind of quote unquote DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion circles, we talk about building generational wealth, and that is a way that we decrease systemic disparities. And so I just want to highlight the point, bring it home, say it again, that what you are doing by providing a soft place for people to land and helping people to build their credit and housing people, you are not only helping the individual in that moment, but you're building a pipeline to building that generational wealth. You just said that people who were guests and members with you have then gone on to build or to buy their own house. And the thing is, one of the first stops on the generational wealth train is owning property, right? Because when you own property, you build equity. So that you are creating an opportunity by solving, serving the first step on that journey. And so I just think it's really, really important to talk about that, because when we talk about removing barriers to entry, clearly that's hugely important to you. And I think it's really important that we call that out and acknowledge and honor the work that you're doing to start people on that journey. So again, I'm going to say thank you. I have this big old shit-eating grin on my face. It's ridiculous.
Well, I appreciate it. I mean, although seriously, it's not my story, right? I mean, I often hear about these things and the kind of transformational life stories from these members, but I played very little role, right? I mean, of course,
you're a steward.
First and foremost, I have an incredible team who helps make everything work, and I am the first to admit that I'm an ideas guy and a creative problem solver, but to build the structure, I usually rely on other folks to do that. But even more important than that, the best thing that we can do is to create opportunities. But it's really incumbent on those members or those hosts to take advantage of those opportunities. And the best thing that we can do is really just provide more choices than those that are otherwise available. And that's the most empowering, impactful thing that I think we can do. We can't force people to take advantage of those opportunities, but we're fortunate to see that a lot of folks do. And it's inspiring to see that, see when they do. And I owe a lot of my own kind of personal career success to a lot of those opportunities that I had early on, just would love to see more and more people have access to those same types of opportunities.
For sure. Well, and I would reiterate that you're very humble, and I think that's wonderful. You know, when I talk about innovator, people are always like, "Oh, it's such a great idea," and I'm like, "It's barely an idea. It is a community of people who create what we are building, the culture and the championship." And so I totally get it. I call myself a steward. People are like, "You're the boss." And I'm like, "No." Weirdly enough, people sometimes call me fearless leader. And I'm like, if you think I am at all fearless, then you have not spent 5 minutes with me. And I think that that's totally kind of natural to the entrepreneurial process. Like, if you're not scared, you're doing something wrong. But I love how humble you are. But I'm probably going to make you a little bit uncomfortable here. Are you ready? I'm going to stick it to you a little bit. Are you proud?
You know, there are, it's funny. I posted something this morning on Facebook about one of my other companies, where when I am proud is when I see successes or impacts that I really don't feel like I've had anything to do with, but that have been the result of some of my early efforts or ideation.
Yeah.
I still own a part of a construction company, and talk about like that. One of the proudest moments of my career is driving by a house and seeing our sign out front and not having any idea how that job got sourced, or knowing anything about it, but knowing that it was going to be done really, really well and probably better than I could have done on my own.
You empowered your people to do it. And that's a job, my friend. Right. That is a job, and it's not something that everybody can do well. So you should be proud of that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with PadSplit. Like, I tell the story about Kiyosha or Gene, who are two of those examples who purchased their own homes, and acknowledging that really I was not involved in the process for their successes, but just to see their successes and to see that they have taken advantage of the opportunities. Those are certainly things that I'm proud of.
There's a lot of power in an idea. And just because you aren't involved in the everyday minutiae, I do think that it's really important to acknowledge the work that you do, because I'm sure it hasn't always been easy.
It's crazy.
Yeah, ex- Exactly. You know, so what you do is very hard. I speak from personal experience when I say I imagine it's probably emotionally draining at times.
Oh yeah.
Not just from an entrepreneurial standpoint, but you know, when you look at when you do work where you are forced to confront systemic issues, disparities, barriers, it can get very disheartening at times, at least for me, and I'm projecting onto you, but I would say that I imagine that there have probably been times in your career when you've had to kind of come to terms with that.
Oh yeah. I mean, it, well, listen, I mean, we face a lot of opposition, as you might imagine, from lots of different circles. I mean,
sure.
There are folks who, quote unquote, don't want those people living in their neighborhoods, and they feel like they have gotten their quality of life in single family homes in a neighborhood, and they're protected, and they really just, they don't necessarily share the belief that the people who serve those communities deserve an opportunity to live in them. And then on the other side, we have a lot of groups who just say, okay, well, rent is theft, and we have no business operating as we're a public benefits corporation, but it's a for profit, and we have no business operating as a for profit and quote unquote exploiting lower income folks. And you know, at the end of the day, what I'd encourage any entrepreneur, prospective entrepreneur, to look at is, and I think just people generally, to focus on what's the vision, like what's your why. And for me, a huge part of that vision is, one, if you're going to solve this problem, you have to create supply, and you have to create access. And if you're not solving those two things, then it's just not worth doing. Could I create a much more profitable business without addressing those two things? No question. There are an innumerable number of businesses that can be incredibly successful addressing some need of a customer that don't address either the creation of new housing supply or the removal of some of those barriers to access. But that is part of our vision and why we do what we do. And every decision that we make as a company or that I make as a CEO ultimately has to align with that vision. For us, it's to be a world-class marketplace that enables the fastest and most cost-effective solutions to the affordable housing shortage. And that means addressing supply and access. I also think that means that if we're going to scale, it has to be as a for-profit endeavor and one that aligns the incentives of all of these groups, and that you cannot sacrifice the needs of one group to the other, because it's just not going to be a sustainable enterprise.
Right.
So I think you can take some solace in just very simple statements around how do you create your vision and why are you doing what you're doing? And you're always going to have people who disagree with you. But no one can ever accuse us of not being super thoughtful about how we've arrived at the model.
Sure. Well, so I'm going to come at you from a slightly different angle. So one of the things that we like to do at Startup Hustle is we like to give actionable advice to our listeners. A lot of our listeners are entrepreneurs themselves, thinking about becoming entrepreneurs. You know, they're at varying points in their journey, but we try to give good advice and good context for folks who are doing the thing. What are they? The makers, doers, and dreamers. And so one of the things that, you know, I've actually had some conversations around removing barriers and ways that you can implement that as an entrepreneur, you know, not necessarily operating within a social justice sphere, you know, like if you're selling a product or if you're selling a specific service, you know, so just as a, for instance, you know, I've had conversations fairly recently about things like drug testing, You know, is that a barrier to entry for folks from marginalized communities who at some point or another may have self-medicated? Or, you know, do we talk about previous felonies and records and, sure. you know, why do we automatically say, oh, I can't hire you, when really we're hoping that our criminal justice system is not punitive, but rehabilitative. And so these are conversations that we can have. So I'm going to ask you, what are some ways that the entrepreneurs listening at home, how can they join you in this fight to remove barriers to entry?
Oh, wow. So
there are probably like 20 different answers to that yeah. question popping into your head right now, but you know, feel free to just pick a couple.
Sure. Well, I mean, the obvious answer, of course, is to go purchase a pad split home in your community and list it on the platform, right?
Hell yeah.
But
yeah,
I would suggest that
every entrepreneur listening do that.
That's right. I think other than that, the biggest piece of advice I could give is that number one, you can't boil the ocean. You as they say, you have to eat the elephant one bite at a time. I think figure out what is actionable today, where can you have the greatest impact on whatever that vision happens to be. But first and foremost, write the vision, literally, like write it down and be very explicit about which problem you are trying to solve and how you want whatever your solution happens to be. How do you want it to look in 5 years or 10 years? And how do you want it described? And work backwards from there. You know, choose that objective. And then every decision that you make should align with that vision and really use it as a razor to help focus your energies and efforts to determine what is the priority of important next steps to take if you're ultimately going to realize that vision over the next 5 to 10 years. It's funny. I've been a volunteer with this program through the Urban Land Institute called Urban Plan for about 20 years now. And they talk about creating a vision as students are supposed to create a redevelopment model for this fictional community, and everything being based on the vision. And I hadn't done that for Pad Split until I was like 2 years in, and just kind of slap myself upside the head, like you fool, you know, why didn't you do this in your own company? And it was only once, kind of post pandemic, when we were in a remote environment, that I was really forced to align everyone in a fully distributed team. We have over 100 people now. But it just makes the decision-making process so much clearer, to be able to evaluate every action against that vision. I think it's incredibly important for anyone in any endeavor to do that, whether it is an entrepreneurial endeavor, whether it's your career in a more traditional sense, or your personal life, or whatever that happens to be, and ultimately make your key decisions based on what that vision happens to be.
Yeah. For sure. Well, so I'm going to ask you a question, and I've actually been thinking that I want to ask. I don't know if I've ever asked this question as the human question on the show before, but it is actually a question that I ask people. I don't really like small talk, like, what do you do? I think that's a really shitty way to start a conversation with somebody. I don't care about what you do. I care about who you are and what you're passionate about. And so one of the questions that I ask kind of as an icebreaker is this, and I'm really curious to hear your answer. So somebody hands you a blank check. Money is no object. You have unlimited funds to address one societal issue. It can only be for one thing. It can only be for one initiative. It can only be for you. You can't you can't say, I want to fix universal healthcare or create universal healthcare. You have to create like a program. Where do you put that money?
That's a great one.
I wanted to ask you specifically this one because I think you're going to have a really interesting answer. Like I said, I've never asked that one before.
I ask
it in my personal life all the time.
No pressure, right? Yeah, I mean, I would, honestly, I think it would probably be a fund of some kind towards entrepreneurship. Yeah. And I think if I could pick, I truly believe in the power of small business and entrepreneurs, and just as I'm sure you can relate, I mean, the level of difficulty and commitment that it takes is really overwhelming. But if I could provide unlimited source of funds, it would really be to fund new business enterprises. And I think I would do it certainly with mentorship as a part of it. I got a ton of value out of the Techstars program. I didn't know anything about technology, really.
We love Techstars around the Startup Hustle offices. We've done several shows related to Techstars.
the biggest thing that I can point to is just the power of the network of Techstars and how that fundamentally changed the future of our business. And as I think we have certainly for the last 20 or 30 years, really concentrated all of or most of that investment in opportunities in Silicon Valley. And I truly believe that talent is universal and it is international. And it is not at all correlated to not just geography, but income group or certainly ethnicity. And any way that we can create universal access to opportunity so that when someone has an idea, they have an ability to have the financial resources to pursue that endeavor, as well as access to the mentorship of others. And we live in a world where that's really more possible today than it ever has been at any point in the past. And so I think that's definitely where I would go. And I strongly believe in the power of entrepreneurs and small businesses to solve the problems that are closest to them and solve those problems. I think the people who are closest to problems are most capable of solving them. And so just giving folks the ability to address those problems that are closest to them would be the most compelling thing I can think of to do with that blank check.
I love that. And you know, I firmly believe that investing in entrepreneurship means an investment in communities. Entrepreneurs are problem solvers, but they're also economic drivers. Sure. So thank all of you entrepreneurs at home listening for the work that you do to not just sell your stuff, but to make our society better. Well, Atticus, I got to tell you, we have come to the end of our time together. We've actually gone a little bit over time, but I don't even care because that was a great conversation. But I do want to say thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Absolutely. No, thanks. Thanks again. This was a lot of fun. And as always, I really appreciate this opportunity.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, and you know what we appreciate, dear listeners? We appreciate Startup Hustle's sponsor, Fullscale.io. Today's episode of Startup Good Lord. Today's episode of Startup Hustle was sponsored by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Also want to remind you that if you want more Startup Hustle in your life, definitely check us out on social channels. You can find us at Startup Hustle Podcast on Instagram. You can find Startup Hustle TV, where I and the other hosts sometimes make fools of ourselves and cuss a lot about being entrepreneurs. Go to YouTube, search Startup Hustle, and it should pop right up, but definitely keep an eye out for that. And thank you so much for taking time out of your busy, busy schedules to listen to us. We will catch you on the flip side.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.